Hi, Mackenzie.
Hey, Lamar.
So we're watching Dune today, or talking about Dune, which we watched already, but you know I'm not a big science fiction guy, so it's going to be an interesting discussion today. Just a little teaser there, forewarning for the folks tuning in just for this episode. But is there a specific genre of film that you tend to not gravitate toward, or that you have a harder time stomaching?
I think generally speaking, like we've talked about this a little bit, horror, but like specific kind of horror I don't love, like kind of gory horror, just like for the sake of being ridiculous, I don't love, like tropey stuff.
Those are like two different things. When you say gory for the sake of, do you mean silly stuff like Evil Dead, where it's intentionally like buckets of blood just for the sake of it?
Not silly stuff, like
or
stuff
are you
that
talking
just
like brutal stuff that it's like, oh, how did they do that? But still, I don't want to see that.
I don't really care about seeing it. It's okay. The like Saw, for example. I hated the Saws. I think that's ridiculous. I think those are so stupid. Those are the kinds of gore horror, I guess, that I'm like not a fan of. But the other genre I would say in general is, who doesn't hate a Hallmark film, right? Like a romancy romance. Those things are garbage. Have you ever watched one of those?
I don't think I've ever actually sat down, but I know there's an audience of people not only who like them completely seriously, but people who ironically love them and think that they're hilarious because they enjoy watching the repetition and just getting their kicks out of it. So it's like a guilty pleasure.
I feel if I reframed it and tried to watch it that way, like almost as a, I'm going to just watch this as a roast. Maybe we do that for one of our eps. Remember, we've talked about doing roasts. Maybe we have to watch a Hallmark film because, man, I have family members who will not be named who are genuinely into them, and I have been forced into watching a few, and yikes, some of the most terrible shit you've ever seen.
I'm struggling right now, and I feel really bummed, especially if they're a listener of ours, but I know one of my friends plays almost like a bingo card every Christmas season or holiday season where they watch these with their family or friends, and they have bingo cards for Hallmark movies. And you're trying to get bingo of the recurring elements of the film. But I can't for the life of me remember. I'm very sorry if you're listening to this.
What would the bingo card, like this, like they kiss in the rain or whatever?
The girl comes from the city and moves back to her hometown, runs into a friend from childhood or meets with a stranger, all that good stuff.
And he convinces her not to go home to the big city and that kind of thing. Oh, that's hilarious.
If she's a lawyer or a journalist of some kind, she's got a very serious job, clearly.
It's so funny. Sidebar, I'm a huge true crime nut, and I listen to a million true crime podcasts and watch a bunch of those, and I watch a ton of Dateline. And fun factoid, if you didn't know, all those scripts that are so tropey and on repeat, one of the Dateline episode hosts is one of the people who writes those, Andrea Canning. If you're a fan of Andrea Canning, she writes these movies. It's crazy.
Good on you, Andrea Canning, with the side hustle.
I know. I'm like, cash in, man. She's obviously getting paid. There's a lot of those, so good on you. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And today we are kicking off Inaugural April with Dune, which Lamar has not seen.
I've seen it now. We're doing the episode.
That's true. That's true.
I had not seen it. I had been, not a huge sci-fi person. I've seen, I think, almost all the Star Wars except for three or four of them. But yeah, just I like sci-fi horror, oddly. But you know that I like horror movies. So like Alien and Aliens, I'm all for that.
Oh, I was just about to ask. I was like, what's a sci-fi horror? Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. So things that combine those two elements, I tend to enjoy. But pure sci-fi just hasn't been a big thing for me. I saw the newest Blade Runner, which same director as this one, and beautiful film and really well put together. But again, I just can't have a hard time getting into it. So,
oof. Okay, we're going to dig deep on this, guys, because I have a lot of questions. But for now, what are we drinking?
So I know we have different drinks today. I mixed up I call this Fire and Spice. A little Dune reference there for you. So I did watch the movie, everybody. And I mixed up some Fireball whiskey, some spiced rum, a little bit of palm liqueur, and then a bit of grenadine. And I topped it off with some cranberry seltzer. And I'm just telling people at home, you got to really work with the proportions on your own, because the first batch I made was just pure cough syrup. But then I changed something, added a little more sugar, a little more seltzer. And the second batch came out pretty damn good. So yeah, fire and spice for me.
Fire and spice. Okay, let's see it though. I want to see the color of this. I was going to say, yeah. Okay. I did two because I couldn't decide and I was feeling creative. Also, we have a long record today, folks, but I can't not tell you about both of them. So I'm starting with my Freeman 75, which is, in case you couldn't tell, a spin on the French 75. But pretty much the only thing I took from that was the bubbles. So it is lemon juice, honey syrup, bourbon topped with champagne. And it is delish. And we will share the recipes out as well once we get this posted on the socials. And then my second one is called the Sandworm, which is some whiskey, preferably Japanese whiskey, in my taste tests. And then some simple syrup, some lemon, and some lime. And also quite delish.
Are you just double fisting over there?
I mean, we got a while to go. Let's do this. Cheers.
You're just cheers.
All right. One, this is inaugural, which is we wanted to share movies with each other that we hadn't seen, which we haven't done actually since I think maybe the first ep. So yeah, it's a cool throwback. And this was a fun one because Dune 2 is out now. If you haven't seen it, many of you probably already have seen Dune 2. So we figured we should make Lamar play some catch up. So yeah.
I didn't realize that the audiences going into this didn't realize it was a two-parter when the first one, literally the opening credits are where it says Dune Part 1, but going into it, the audiences had no idea that it was going to be split into two films.
Which is, it's both surprising and not surprising. I think if you know the story, the pacing, it makes sense. You're like, there's no way we're going to get to everything. But yeah, I don't remember that being public knowledge before we went in there. Yeah, it is long as well in that sense, I will say, of they're covering a lot, but there's a lot of slow movement, I would say, probably. But we can dig into that. But that's why we picked Dune to start us off. But we're going to get into some basics. We're going to do a quick rating because we know, even though the new one is out, and a lot of you have probably seen the first one as well, maybe a handful of you haven't. So Lamar hadn't seen it, so you guys might not have either. So let's do some basics really quick. So the first one came out in 2021. So not too long ago, pretty relatively fast follow, especially given all the strikes and things, which did delay the release of part two as well, but they did pretty well. So the ratings here, I looked at the IMDb rating was like an 8 out of 10. And the Rotten Tomatoes was 83%, I think, for critics and 90%. For audiences. So pretty highly rated. So I feel like you're in a class of your own over there, Lamar.
I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's not for me. It also won 6 Academy Awards, all visual effects, sound type driven, which definitely shows in the film.
Yeah. I mean, I think the production is super solid in that sense for sure. But yeah, some other basics. We've got a director here who, as Lamar pointed out, has done several other things, including Blade Runner. But Denis Villeneuve, who's French-Canadian, whose name I probably just butchered, but we did try really hard. Okay, multiple practice rounds. We'll see how we did.
I think French-Canadians are going to say that you fucked up their name no matter how you pronounce it as an American. You could practice for weeks and you'd probably still get it wrong. So
I know some French-Canadians who will probably yell at me. So that's true. but yeah, so he's done a bunch of great stuff. He did Arrival. If you've never seen Arrival, another sci-fi flick that you probably haven't seen, but I genuinely think this is a really incredible film.
No, I liked Arrival a lot.
Oh, did you?
So, okay. Yeah, and that one was interesting because it didn't fit. I guess that, and I associate it with Ex Machina because those came out around the same time, like maybe a year apart. And that was when I was like, okay, I like this kind of sci-fi, this sort of slow burn and thought-provoking stuff. And I think Dune is closer to that than like a Star Wars, which is more just spaceships and lasers, and Star Wars fans are hating me right now, but
I was gonna say you are gonna get shredded. Like, you are being brave right now. That's impressive. Yeah. But yeah, it's definitely a different type of story for sure. And I think with this one is that he kind of has a really good range. He's done Sicario, Prisoners.
I liked Prisoners a lot.
Yeah, Prisoners was really good. He did obviously Dune 1 and 2. And then what is the one? Oh, Blade Runner. I said that already.
Blade Runner 2049. Yeah,
2049 specifically, which I'll meet you there. that was not my favorite. And I am the anomaly here as well.
It was a little too long. It was gorgeous and beautiful. Great to see on a big TV. But yeah, just a little too long for me. I did want to point out that the balls on Denny for making this and in his mind knowing he was going to stay true to the source material from the 1965 book, but just saying, hey, it's going to take two movies to do this. And the second film hadn't even been greenlit when this was released. They didn't get official green lighting until I think the week, maybe 5 days after this came out, and they made bank at the box office. But the balls it must take to be like, yeah, we're going to do a second film. Fingers crossed.
I mean,
yeah.
I think he just held it hostage, right? He's this is the film. And if you want more, you got to let me make it. And also, like, sci-fi fans are hard fucking core. Like, they will rage if you don't finish their shit. So I think it's a solid
move. That's why we needed a fourth Matrix movie. Thanks, sci-fi fans.
I don't know if we needed that, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, but it's all that to say, he's obviously clearly a really proficient filmmaker and has done a lot of great stuff. The writing for this is really interesting as well. Sounds like he contributed a bit of the writing, but I think the main writers on this are John Spates, who you may know of Doctor Strange, Passengers, The Mummy fame, the newer Mummy, for the record. And I loved the first Doctor Strange. I did not love the second one. So
Wes Craven did, yeah. Wes Craven. Fuck. Sam Raimi.
And I normally like Sam Raimi, but I feel like he destroyed that, TBH. Anyway.
I blame Disney partially on that one, because... Not a well-written film.
Not accurate to source material in any. Anyway, neither here nor there. John Spates for the first one.
He doesn't even do any surgeries.
I know. And the first one is very well-written. He does a surgery or two. He's a doctor.
Second one, he's not even in a hospital for any part of the film. Like, what the fuck?
He's just committed to the craziness of the multiverse at that point, and I think that's some bullshit. But anyway. All that to say, this one's very well written, really interesting story here. And then the other writer on this is Eric Roth, which if you haven't heard of Eric Roth, you have, because he's written basically fucking everything. He did Forrest Gump, Ali, The Horse Whisperer, The Postman, just everything basically in Hollywood at some point this guy has touched, including Killers of the Flower Moon, which we just did. And I didn't even remember that, which just tells you my brain is mush. But yeah, he did that as well. And then I think we have a really solid cast and crew here. A really big
Monstrous cast. Even if you're just right. And I don't mean to diminish it, like to whittle it down to just people whose names I recognized off the bat, because there's a lot of other people who I didn't recognize but are great in this. But even if you just water it down to the people who most are like household names, there's about 10 or 12 of them, and then you have a bunch of other great actors on top of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long list. We will probably forget some, frankly, because there are so many. And also, I will say, just for those listening at home without a list in front of you, it's going to be hard to follow character names as well, but it's a lot of people involved in this plot. But the lead here is, it's a combo in this first film. I will say the core plot is about Paul Atreides. And again, true to the source material, with him being at the center of it all. And that's played by Timothée Chalamet. It's his coming of age tale, really. But in this first one, you also have Oscar Isaac playing Duke Leto Atreides, his father. He's the leader of this noble house, and they live on Caladan to start. And he's the leader of that entire community, the entire planet, basically. So you have him playing. And both of those, I mean, they're in freaking everything. Timothée Chalamet was just in Wonka, which is a great one, but he's also been in all kinds of stuff. Lady Bird, a bunch of things recently. And he's obviously excellent, up and coming, and I don't know, full bona fide star at this point. And Oscar Isaac, same thing. Feels like he's in everything as well. He did a really incredible turn. If you've never seen it, I don't think it's a super popular film, but it was very well done. It was A Most Violent Year. If you haven't seen that.
I have not seen that.
Mm-hmm. That's him and Jessica Chastain, which I just think is like such an incredible combo. And they did, I can't remember the name of the series, but they did a mini series on HBO together as well, which was also really incredible. But yeah, he's awesome. And then we have Rebecca Ferguson, who plays Jessica Atreides, Lady Jessica Atreides, who is not his wife. his concubine. Don't get it twisted. Not his wife. But basically his wife, his life partner. Why does she have to be called a concubine? Can we not? There are multiple references to her as the concubine.
Let's take that word back. Make it a cool thing to be now.
I was going to say, we're going to have to reclaim that one because that's some bullshit here. She's his full-blown partner and mother of his child. And she's a bad bitch, we're going to find out. But she's great as well. She's been in all kinds of stuff. Probably most recently, other than Dune, the Mission Impossibles. Like the more recent Mission Impossibles.
Yeah, she's also in the new Apple TV series Silo, which is based on a different book series that I really dig. And it's borders, it's less sci-fi and more dystopian, I'd say. Mm. But she's pretty good in that. She's doing her best American accent in there. But
so you have a very niche non-sci-fi liking.
Dystopia involved. I'm game.
Because you're very adjacent to it with a couple of these. So that's interesting. Okay, cool. I need to check out Silo because I haven't heard about that. But Jason Momoa as well, who's Duncan, who's basically like a soldier that is pretty close with Paul. Jason Momoa, I don't think needs much introduction. Aquaman, among other things, Game of Thrones, etc.
Khal Drogo. And thank God for him in this, because for the first 30 minutes of this film, everyone was so friggin' miserable and morose and quiet, and everybody was whispering their dialogue. And then Momoa shows up, and it's like, oh, thank God, it's going to be a little light at times, at least. And then after that, it got a little different. But
as Khal Drogo, he was also pretty morose, so it was nice to see him to get to let loose a little.
He was a little broody. He had the eye makeup, and he was a little MCR fan riding his horse around, but no.
And then you learn that he's just a soft, squishy teddy bear on the inside. It just takes a minute to figure that out. But yeah, he's obviously done all kinds of stuff as well. But then we have Stellan Skarsgård, who is, I think, just a great staple in Hollywood. It feels like he's been in so many things. And he's actually Swedish, but which is why he has that beautiful accent, but it's fun. And he was in Thor, obviously, a bunch of the Marvel flicks, because he plays Selvig throughout all of that. But he's also been in all kinds of other stuff. He's actually been on The Simpsons, I saw, which I have never seen that episode because I don't watch The Simpsons, but he's apparently done everything, including The Simpsons.
And is he the father? Do you know offhand if he's the father of the
Alexander Skarsgårds? Yes, they're all
Bill Alexander. That's all his flock. Okay, uh-huh, you're doing this with your hands.
People, it's one big happy family. Was the motion there? Yeah, big happy family. That's
and he
all
also
of them.
Sat through apparently 7 hours of makeup a day to do this part, and he just plays such a terrifying villain throughout. So props to him for putting the work in on both ends.
He does. And I just like, that's, again, speaks to his range. Like he in the Marvel things is one thing, like he plays Selvig one way, of course, but he's also been in Cinderella, for example. He was in Mamma Mia. He was in, like, he can play anything. And that's what I love about him. He's such a great actor. Yeah. And then we have Josh Brolin, who plays Gurney, who is also a soldier, but kind of Paul's, I would say, like, mentor type, where he's trying to teach him how to fight, teach him how to survive beyond just fighting, like just survival. And he's a really interesting character throughout. And then we have Stephen McKinley Henderson, who is one of the right-hand men, him and Gurney, right-hand men for the Duke, for Leto. And then there's a ton more. There's Javier Bardem. There's Sharon Duncan Brewster. There's Chang Chen. There's Dave Bautista. And then, of course, there's Zendaya. And she doesn't make much of an appearance in this one, but people
for how much I remember the marketing having her in it, I was surprised by how little she, without spoiling it, how little she's involved in this first part.
Yeah. And
but again, I guess they were marketing it as the whole story, so they didn't want to like piss off the fans of like, where's this character, not knowing there was a part two coming.
Yeah, I think they had to include her because people would be like, hey, where's she at? I mean, she's such a key character at some point. So I think they had to include her in that way for sure. So that's your core casting of characters. But to Lamar's point, there are a fuck ton. So we're not going to go through them all. But a super quick plot summary for those of you who maybe haven't seen it yet. The noble Atreides family becomes embroiled in a war for control over the galaxy's most valuable asset, spice, while its heir becomes troubled by visions of a dark future.
Super spooky vague stuff.
Spooky, vague.
I got big. Did you ever watch Lost back in the day?
No. I mean, I saw an episode once or twice, but yeah, no.
Yeah, I got big sort of science versus faith vibes from this. It also helped that I was also reading Stephen King's The Stand at the same time, like when I watched this film. And that also is like science versus faith dystopian type thing. So, yeah.
Look at you. You got a theme. You had a theme going.
I have had a month of just content. And that one doesn't even start out that way. It starts out as a global plague, like an epidemic. And yeah, that hit home a little bit 4 years after 2020. But yeah.
I feel like this month has also been a ton of content for me, but not a theme. I didn't have a theme, so I'm a little jealous. But
One out for next month, maybe.
There we go. I forgot to mention, disrespectfully, I apologize, the score, Hans Zimmer, which
the same guy that did Cool Runnings?
Yeah, classic. Which I know we mentioned on Cool Runnings that he did this, but I got to tap it here again. He did this, and it's an incredible score. It's beautiful. So yeah, he's just a genius. No big deal.
And it's not really a spoiler, but he does get a little cameo in this film. He appears as a bagpiper early on in the film. So he's actually in there playing music that he scored for it. So I thought that was clever.
I love that. Okay. So we're going to give you guys a super quick rating and then we're going to dig into some spoilers. So I think it's clear that Lamar, it's not for him. But what's your rating?
When I say it's not for me, that just means I don't want to sit down and watch this again. I'm not saying in any way that it's a bad film. And I give this a lot of credit for, again, being a book from 1965 and everyone involved, not just the director, but the writers and even the cast, a lot of them have stated that they loved the book as kids. So that's why they wanted to be involved. Everyone wanted this to be a by the book interpretation of the source material. So when you watch this, if you've never read the book and you're now watching this film 60 years later, you're going to be like, oh, this is tropey. It's following a lot of not just science fiction tropes, but just plot of like when people die and when the prophecies and all these different things where it seems almost by the books, especially if you've seen Star Wars too.
Yeah.
But I give this a lot of credit for, yes, sticking to it 60 years later and being willing to put this out knowing that it might come off that way. So I give it a bit of a cushion on that of realizing that the movie came out when it did, but it's based on this book from long ago. So I feel like I repeated myself there three times, but all that to say,
you're just really making your point, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, but all that to say, visually, I think this is a 10. I think not just the visuals, but the sound. I think the use of sound in this is incredible. It's very much reminds me of a Nolan film in the way that it uses sound and rising and falling crescendos of sound. But visually, just the use of fog and sand and visual effects and light and the makeup and all these different things. There's a reason it won the Oscars that it did. So I would give it a 10 on that front. And then I think for me personally, this is going to be like a 7. It's not something I ever want to watch again, but I did enjoy it aside from, as I said, feeling as though, okay, I saw that coming, but that's not really the point of this. I think it's meant to be sat down and just be blown away by how beautiful this is.
Yeah. I mean, and to your point, everybody in this wanted to be involved because of the quality of the story and the history that they had with it and their own nostalgic connection to this story. I mean, I think all of that is a great point of why this material might still land with other people, even though, and we'll get into it, I think it does run a little long, but I think it's very well done. I think stunning visually to look at, which like is this guy's shtick, obviously. Again, he did Blade Runner 2049, was also beautiful. And so I really enjoy like physically watching it. I think the first one for me does have a little bit of a pacing issue on the first watch, but then on the second watch, and I don't know if this is because I had seen it the first time, it didn't hit me quite the same way. I was, okay, I feel fine with this pacing on a second watch. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was interesting. But that was my only complaint. I remember the first time like watching it in theaters. But I think I would do like a 7.5, like a 7.5. I really enjoy this story.
I thought you would have gone higher, actually.
No, I mean, I think it's a great film and I think it's very well done. I think independent of part two, that's what I would give it. Like part two, we can talk about later, is I think even better, actually. But I mean, this independent of the part two, because of the way that it ends, actually, I don't think it's a bad stopping point, But I just think it's like this coda that stalls. Mm-hmm. And so it as a standalone film, it's that's why I would say, yeah, like probably bring it down to 7.5 or what have you. But I get why he did it where he did, for sure.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. Apparently, they had filmed some extra scenes to take place after the ending of this one. They had a different stopping point in mind. But I'm not sure what made them change their mind, if it was in the editing room or if they realized, hey, we have a pretty good feeling that this second one is going to get greenlit. So maybe we save some of this footage for the second one. So technically, they had already started shooting Dune 2 before it even got greenlit.
And I think, again, I think if I think about the way the other one opens, again, no spoilers, I think you're opening a can of worms that are not, it's not as easy to find a better breaking point, right, is I think what I would say. So again, I get it. I get where it has landed. But I think the first time through, when you're just, again, considering it on its own, it makes sense that it just stepped.
The only other thing I want to say before we get into spoiler territory, and if you want to add anything else, just outside of my personal opinion, I know I've already pissed off the Star Wars fans today. But
yeah, they're fucking gone. Thanks a lot.
If you're considering watching this film and you've seen Star Wars and you're like me, where you're like, I don't know that sci-fi is for me, consider this. These are not Lamar's words. These are Denis Villeneuve's words. And he said, quote unquote, it is Star Wars for adults. So suck on that, Star Wars fans. But that's what he said. So take those words with a grain of salt. If you're thinking, I do think you should watch this. I think if you have a big TV, it's great. If you have a good sound system, it's great. I think this movie might be meant to be watched on edibles, because I feel like I might have even enjoyed it more if I were high. But yeah,
for sure.
Definitely watch
it. For sure. I totally agree. I think you should absolutely watch it. I do think we just, opened up some hate mail from Star Wars fans with that one. But so many people do say that. I can't remember. I was talking about this at work this week. I think I was mentioning to somebody that we were going to do this, and they were like, yeah, I just saw that, but it's basically Star Wars. And I was like, but it's not. It's
Let me
different.
Explain to you how timelines and source material work. Because this came out, 5 years before Star Wars, or 10 years?
Yeah, but the source material. See, this is where the ongoing debate comes from, because the source material for Star Wars supposedly predates the source material for Dune. So that's the debate. But
I don't believe anything George Lucas says.
Again, with the hate mail. Thank you so much. We love George Lucas. We apologize on behalf of Lamar. Thank you from We Drink and We Watch Things. Okay. Yeah, so spoiler time. As we say here on the pod, turn around, don't drown.
I like that that's become the official spoiler. And we just stole that from Texas.
Yeah. I'm from here. I get to steal it. I don't give a shit. So yeah, turn around, don't drown, spoiler time. But yeah, I think one thing I want to open with is something you mentioned in the intro, is people saying that this was really true to the source material, and the source material is so strong, and people, it has such a huge fandom. And asterisk, I have read Dune, but I was very young. I don't remember. I can't do an effective comparison because it's just been so long. But I do think that most people felt that way. And one of the, I just recently listened to a Smartless episode. Again, if I just keep mentioning them, they're going
to
keep
mentioning
us. Well,
you've got Janelle listening to them now. So you can.
Yes. I'm doing the work, man. Yeah. I am hustling for them. All right. It's a great pod. Anyway, they had Josh Brolin on, and he, of course, talked about Dune. And he was mentioning that he has a very good friend, like years and years old, a buddy of his, who is obsessed with all the Dune source material. He's read all the whole series 3 times through, whatever. And he came and saw a screening of the film with Josh. And as he said at the time, he's a 48-year-old guy. He jumped up at the end and he started screaming, yes, that's it. Yes. So like uber fans are like, this is the stuff. This is so well done. And yeah, I think that's what carries this for a lot of fans of Dune, for sure. All right, starting a little bit, we're not going to go like plot point by plot point, because it is a lot of material, but I think there's some kind of core things we got to understand, which is, again, this is opening this family, Atreides, that is obviously very well respected and trusted throughout the universe. It's clear this is a universe story, guys. This is not a country. This is not a single planet. This is a universe story. And this universe is implied to be ruled by this Emperor Shaddam. And the Atreides family rules over Caladan. So you have these, basically what equates to fiefdoms, but they're planets. And so they run Caladan, and to much success, much respect. Much success. Their family is thriving, doing well. This is a more lush planet, it seems. Maybe Earth-esque, honestly, from some of the images.
Sweden-esque to me.
Yeah, Sweden, was Norway.
It was somewhere up there that they filmed.
I think like Norway-ish. Yeah, like coastal, but green and also cold, but, you know, clearly has some seasons. So that's good. So it's that juxtaposed against Arrakis, which is this planet that is literally a desert. It's just a full ass desert. And what the initiating action of the whole story is that the Atreides family is being pulled from Caladan and given fiefdom over Arrakis instead. And they're being asked to go rule Arrakis, again, very different from where they have ruled thus far. And it's presented to them as they're removing this Baron Harkonnen, who currently is running that planet. He's not being successful over the natives, quote unquote, the freemen. And they need Duke Leto Atreides to come in and clean up shop, right? And so that's the PR campaign. But the everybody knows that this emperor is jealous of the Duke. They feel like he's a direct threat to the emperor with how well-liked he is, how respected he is, how successful their family is. And this is a get him out of the way, give him this impossible task and get him over to this planet so that they can basically, essentially, at some point in some way, remove him from power. And you don't know at the beginning exactly how they're going to do this. You just know that it's not a good move. You can tell that from the top, right?
Yeah, there's a lot going on. And I always appreciate when a story throws you right in and doesn't spoon feed you. I do think there's a few conversations of exposition in this where they do have to explain some things for our sake. But I like that they just thrust you right into it from the beginning. I actually didn't even follow some of the things you talked about. I thought they were just going to this planet temporarily, but their home was still on that other, the first place you mentioned.
Yeah.
I didn't realize they were literally being, you know, selling their old house and moving into it.
Yeah, they imply, I don't remember if he says it or if I'm just remembering this from the book way back when, I don't know. But Paul at some point is, do you think we'll ever go back to Caladan? And somebody tells him no. Like, we're not ever going back. But I think that's also, again, stemming from people know that they're not sure how or what's going to take place, but they know that this is not a move that is meant to be successful for the Atreides. No one believes that they are going to last in this position for a number of reasons, right? Yeah. And the Duke is under the impression that, or I guess maybe forcing himself to believe that he can make this work. Right. He knows that this is what is happening politically speaking, but he is thinking, I've done this before. I can do this again. I'm a great leader. I'm going to find a way to bond with these people, the freemen, and I'm going to get them to our side. And we're going to just be so successful that the emperor can't deny it, is his mindset, and hopes that he can achieve all that before the emperor seeks to remove him in some way, right? So,
and he was doing a good job of it too when they first got there, and there was this unease, this unsettled sort of environment. But he does go and has this, he sees the fear in the, I guess, indigenous folks there, for lack of a better term, the people living in Arrakis who have been governed before by unfair and cruel leaders. And maybe it's not governed isn't the right word for it, but they're just trying to live their lives out and they're being mistreated.
Really oppressed is the word for it, right? They're being oppressed. Yeah.
But so he is doing a better job. He has all the best intentions and unfortunately doesn't really get a chance to finish up the job.
And he does have some key failures from a production standpoint. So the core thing we can't get away from is that the reason he's being asked to, quote unquote, control the natives, aka the freemen, is because they are interrupting spice production. And up to this point, you don't know a ton about it. But to your point, they have to give us some exposition dialogue to explain what it is, which is spice is this spice, literally, but it is a hallucinogen is one part of it. Makes you trip out, which, like, who doesn't want to preserve some trippy shit?
I do.
But also it powers interstellar travel, which, again, we've established this as a universe story. They need to be able to travel.
It'd be funny if that were the case on Earth, too. Right. So it turns out LSD also powers rocket ships, y'all. And then all the druggies. I don't know which I'd rather do. What should I invest in?
I just have a question. Have we tried this yet? Have we checked? Maybe we should check. I don't know. It feels like maybe it could work. But yeah, so weird combo.
Astronauts were killed in a freak NASA accident today. Trying to put...
At the suggestion of we drink and we watch things. Yeah, no, definitely a strange combo for a substance of any kind. But
yeah,
here we are. That's
what... Did we need it to do both? Could
we have... needed to do both? Hey,
for the
you will at some point need it to do both. But I also think, yes, you could have introduced something else as well. But anyway, spices sacred to the Freeman is the other thing to consider because of the hallucinogenic properties that are faith-based for them. So that's another thing to understand, is that's part of the oppression of people like the Baron Harkonnen, who was previously ruling over Arrakis, which was that they were limiting the Freeman's access to spice and or killing them to prevent them from harvesting it. And Baron Harkonnen was very successful at harvesting it, other than the interruptions from the Freeman. But the failures that Duke has when he first gets here, Duke Atreides, is he has multiple interruptions with his production because of equipment that's not left for him, them not knowing how to harvest spice the same way. Like, Harkonnen didn't leave him a manual. You know what I mean? He wasn't like, here, I wish you much success.
Yeah, he burned up all the VHS tapes that you used to have to watch when you started a new job. Like, he just burned those and was like,
he just set them on fire. He was like, screw you. I'm going to leave you the wimpiest ships. Good luck. Bye-bye. So yeah, he was not set up for success in that way. But where he does succeed, to your point, is connecting with the Freeman themselves. And in this case, he reaches a real detente with Stilgar, who's played by Javier Bardem and is a representative of the Freeman. And he basically gives his blessing over, these guys aren't bad. We're going to find a way to live and work together. Mm. But that's where it stops before shit hits the fan. And this is where we find out that this has all been a scheme, that the Emperor has sent him there to fail, and Harkonnen's going to go attack the planet and try to retake it, but with the help of the Emperor's troops. So, like, they are secretly going to assist in this process, and that's not super clear. They know something bad was going to happen, but they don't know that this is all a move on the part of the Emperor as well. The Emperor at least is giving his blessing to.
Yeah, that was, I remember I wrote this in my notes, of these people have very selective prophecies. Feels like there's a lot of prophecy. There's a sort of messiah figure at the center of this, and is this stuff being handed down intentionally? Is that all part of the scheme? And I guess I'll figure that out in part two. But just the whole prophecy component of it, I was like, it just seems like nothing ever is exactly what it seems. And it feels like everyone sees this coming, but they still don't do enough to prepare for it. I don't know.
So it's interesting you say that. I think what we're dealing with here, and I could be wrong, but this is just my interpretation, is I feel like we have two parallel stories, and you have a purely faith-based approach to it, right? Of these certain people, which we should touch on. Lady Jessica is a member of the Bene Gesserit, which is the faith-based community that has built around these prophecies, right? And it's largely a matriarchal community, and the members are all women, and Lady Jessica is one of them. And it's led by this other woman who's the head matriarch of it all. And they have, you know, some mystical capabilities that are not fully delved into in this film, and you get more in the next one. But in general, they have some access to prophecy. And they do believe, yes, that there is some sort of messiah figure who will bring all of this together and bring lushness and success. And basically what is referenced as being like an oasis to Arrakis and to the people. And the Freeman believe in this prophecy as well. So like the Bene Gesserit and the Freeman have kind of a parallel interpretation of all of this prophecy. And kind of we look at the government, whatever you want to call it, emperors, dukes, all these things, they work around it, so to speak. Like they don't really fully believe in it. They tolerate it, or they do what they can to not upend it too much. And they do have some levels of partnership with the Bene Gesserit at various points. And Lady Jessica was, you find out, asked to bear a daughter, to have a child with the Duke. But she was asked to have a daughter, and she railed against that, and she chose to have a boy, which is, again, implied that they can control this.
Can women do that, Mackenzie?
I call me in a few years. Maybe I'll have an answer for you. I don't think so. I don't think it's one of our skill sets, to be honest. They do say if you like hang upside down or something. I don't know. Anyway, but yeah, so she controls it and she has a boy instead. And it's told to her by the high priestess that it's because of her arrogance, because she believes she's going to give birth to this Messiah savior figure, which is Paul. And she, at this point, really believes that's who he is. And that in her training him, but then also you get that juxtaposed against Gurney training him. And so I think what's interesting about Paul is that he has these two different storylines coming together in his one character. Different approaches.
I liked the character of Paul in that aspect where he has his father who is trying to teach him how to lead and how to fight. And he's going daily, he's doing these training sessions of trying to murder other people basically and protect himself and survive, like you said earlier. But then on his mother's side, he has more of this skill that she's trying to teach him. And he's also seeing these visions and he's trying to interpret them. So I did find that to be a pretty interesting character to take those two things and just literally have it be like, well, I got this from my dad and this from my mom. I'm Paul. Nice to meet you.
Yeah. And I think that's the point, right? Is he's supposed to be this amalgamation of the two. And if we're talking in terms of Star Wars, like bring balance to the Force. Like he's going to be a Luke, right? He's going to bring the balance that they've been looking for. He has these two backgrounds that really complement each other and lend him to being a good leader because he can understand both sides. At least that's what's being implied this whole time, right? He's a young man and he's maybe not quite ready. That's definitely also implied. He's a young guy who doesn't care about all these lessons as much and wants to just shoot the shit with his buddies. But
and he's super handsome, but he doesn't even make a big deal of it or anything. And he has great hair.
Yeah, you don't see a mirror once. He doesn't do a hair check. Yeah. Not a once. Yeah. Yeah. He's this great character, right? That we're coming to love and see. And again, shit hits the fan. They are attacked. And it's because they're betrayed by somebody in their own household. Like they know the threat of it all, but they don't, for whatever reason, suspect or see to their own household as being a threat. And it is their physician, their doctor, what have you, is the person who gets the Harkonnens in. And it's because they've threatened him. They've taken his wife. It's not that he wants to betray them, but he's put in a position to where he almost has to, so to speak.
Which, but then big surprise, they don't hold up their end of the bargain. I wrote that down of, curse your sudden but inevitable betrayal of just, my wife now, reunite me with my wife. And he's like, and then he shoots it. I don't remember if that's exactly how it happened, but.
Basically, I mean, he immediately kills him and is like, yeah. Oh, you, because she's dead. She's obviously dead. But that is one, I think, moment of frustration in the whole story for me. But again, I guess you don't have a story without it. But that they know that they're under this threat and they're not watching their people closely. You know what I
did. I can't take credit for this. I think I jumped on Reddit and was looking at comments on the first movie as soon as I finished it. And somebody said the whole point is that they were taking precautions and they knew something was fishy, but without the combination of that sort of Judas figure in this equation, as well as the Emperor's army or mercenaries, whatever they might be joining with the Harkonnen. And that's what it's those two things that they couldn't really see coming that spell their doom. So it wasn't that they weren't prepared. I was like, why does he only have Oscar Isaac only has four guards at his door? Okay, cool. And then he just walks around the castle. But yeah.
Yeah, I think they do a good job of positioning it as like this was inevitable. It was going to happen in some form at some point. But yeah, it's easy to tear down the individual moments. But I think it makes sense in the overarching
story. We don't want a victim blame here.
We don't want a victim
blame. Poor Leto.
It's the Duke's fault. It's Leto's fault. But they do show Leto. You can't tell quite at first whether or not he gets killed or captured. That something hits him and you're like, ooh, is he dead? And simultaneously, his family, Paul and his mother, Jessica, are escaping, essentially. And they do escape, but they don't know the fate of their dad. Like, they can't find him. They don't try to just leave him, but they have to escape. And they do, but they don't know what's happening to him. And they assume that he's dead, but they're holding out hope that he's not. And it turns out that he's not, but only for a little while. So he comes face to face with the Baron. He figures out that this was all a scheme. He's been stripped down and humiliated, and he's in front of all of his henchmen and all these things. And he does the best he can in that moment to sacrifice himself to try and take out as many of them as possible. And he takes out a good chunk. But
it somehow kills all of them in the room except for the Baron, which I was a little perturbed by that because he's just locked in there the whole night with them. And then he's found the next day and it's, oh, he's just really sick. Everyone else is dead, but he's just a little sick. We'll put him in
And I don't remember the details, but he is not, it's hard to describe. He's not fully human. I mean, think of him as like part machine. And he has, you saw that he's got this long, like floating.
Yeah, when he's hovering and like in the background and then slowly blurrily approaches Leto, that scene's pretty cool.
Yeah, so he has an anti-gravity device because of his extreme weight to hold him up. But they also imply that he has several other like aspects to him that have been worked on, surgery, cyborged, whatever. He also gets these treatments, as we see. He goes into this like oil and milk mixture and what have you. And so I think he's not susceptible to things in the same way as other folks because he's obviously had various treatments to make himself somewhat impervious. But it is frustrating to see that literally, basically everyone else dies but him, and he's fucking hanging on the ceiling.
Yeah, I think that I'm now curious to watch the second one because with Chalamet being in this, I have to wonder if the Baron just drinks fizzy lifting juice and this is just a Wonka crossover, because I think that makes a lot of sense.
We're bringing it all together. Full circle. I like it. I like it. But you know he's going to get kicked out of the factory for that, so...
That is true. Maybe that bath he was taking was all chocolate. I can't speak. I don't know how Dune ends. I never read the book, but if it's just a Willy Wonka setup, I'm game.
No chocolate for you, Baron. But yeah, anyway, so all this to say, a bunch of hijinks ensue. He does obviously lose his father, which is a really terrible moment for him. He does reunite with Gurney and a couple others, and they tell him, like, you're the Duke now. And he now has to really take on that leadership. And again, speaking to earlier where we're like, hey, he's not really ready. He's really young. He does come into his own almost immediately. You see him start to really take seriously this responsibility and seemingly take it on as a part of honoring his father too. Of, I need to do this. This is what my father wanted. And you see that kind of evolve for him of what that looks like. Is it that he gets spice production on track and he lobbies the emperor to marry his daughter or something or what have you? And he runs all these ideas past them. But this is before he starts to really interact with the Freemen, where they find them and they start to connect with them. And he has to survive. He has to essentially survive the desert. And that really changes his whole trajectory as a character, is encountering this Freeman community and connecting with them and learning their ways of the desert.
Yeah, there's a few moments in there that you mentioned that I for as slow as some parts of this are, because it is a story-driven, not an action-driven film, the scenes of... We talked about sort of the extraction earlier where the digger or whatever it is about to get swallowed by the sandworm. That scene is friggin' incredible to watch. Yeah. And then the other one is what you were just mentioning, where he and his mom are being kidnapped or taken to be killed. And they do the breakout and he finally uses the voice or whatever it's called to get them to stop. And I thought that scene was really well done. Everything, once the sort of inevitable betrayal happens, everything after that was pretty money for me.
Yeah, I think he, once the, I guess, plot kicks off there, you see a lot of forward momentum of Duncan sacrificing himself to save them and help them keep going. The Dr. Liet Keynes, I can't remember how we say her name, but she helps them escape as well. And you come to find out that she considers herself Freeman, which hasn't been implied up to now. She's a mystery, right? And she turns out to really help them and lure a sandworm away. And to your point, like sacrifice herself, get eaten by the sandworm to do all of that. And then when he interacts with, I think what's interesting about when he interacts with the Freeman is he's already started to have some of these visions. We've seen that kind of peppered throughout of he's starting to have some of these visions and it's not entirely clear why. It seems like he's sensitive to spices, what they say.
Yeah, he's literally getting high on his own supply.
He's getting high. He's just walking around getting high. It's just in the air and he's just Hi.
And his dad's just standing. You know what? His dad wasn't that great because he was just watching it happen, letting his little son be a burnout.
Didn't stop him at all. Didn't teach. He taught him so many lessons, but not that. You're totally fine getting high, kid. But yeah, so he does. He you know, basically starts to see a lot of things that connect some dots, but not others. Things play out differently than you think they will when he runs into that tribe.
I liked that a lot.
Yeah, so when he's encountering the Freeman, he has to essentially fight for his place by fighting Jameis, who essentially says, no, he can't go forward. He can't go with us. I'm challenging Stilgar's leadership, and I'm saying, no, we have to fight this guy. And he's got to win. It's to the death to be able to stay with us. And Paul hesitates. And that's where I think like some of his empathy is showing, and some of his is like, I don't want to kill you. And they think as Freeman that he's fucking around with them. And he's, no, I just don't want to kill this man. And they're like, no, like, you gotta, that's our way. And I think another part of that they don't quite touch on is he is already attached to this man because of these visions. He feels like he knows this person. He doesn't want to kill him. He feels like he's learned something from him.
Yeah, he thinks that is one thing I really liked. My joke about the prophecy thing earlier, I like that the prophecies in this are very selective and they're interpretable, and maybe it's branching timelines or something like that, where maybe in one world they do become buddies and they are, he's training him in the way of the blade, I think is what he says in the vision. But it turns out training him in the way of the blade is just him having to kill this guy in order to get initiated into the club, essentially.
Yeah. And I think that's a big moment of shift for Paul as a character, of like him having to do this. And she says it to them. They're like, is he messing around? And she's, no, he's never killed a man. He doesn't want to do this, because it does. It fundamentally changes you, obviously. And so you see that happen for him. But he joins them. He wins, spoiler alert. And then he chooses to join them because he's trying to do what he thinks his father would want him to do, which is to continue this alliance to bring peace to Arrakis. He thinks this is the way now to bring this peace to Arrakis, and that he's gonna find a way to bring this all together. And this is where, of course, briefly, he encounters Zendaya's character, where and that's Chani, who we get introduced to for only a split second. And you see her being very skeptical of him. But again, he's already had visions of her.
Yeah, he's seen the teaser trailers.
Yeah, he's seen the teaser trailers. He's seen he gets to make out with this girl. He's, ooh, hey girl, hey. But he doesn't make a move right away. I'm shocked.
Could've She's been like sexting him through spice visions. And now he's, all right, I'm here. Like, let's
there
do this.
It is. Maybe that's what it is. He's like, it's not so much about dad. It's if I go with them, right, I'm gonna get the hookup, right? Yeah, right. Yeah.
I wonder if Tom Holland was jealous watching this of Tim Chalamet having, you know, visions of his lady. Just it's his dream girl.
That's a fight I want to see. Tom Holland and Timothy Chalamet.
But just no shots to the face, please.
I know. You're both too beautiful, okay? But that's essentially, guys, that's where it ends. And so, to Lamar's point, when you don't know the second half or you don't know the source material, it's a hard place to end. Of we just went through all this turmoil and it feels like very little denouement to get to this point of resolution, because it's not really a denouement. It's just a pause, right? It's just a pause between these stories, and you got to watch Dune 2 to get the rest.
Yeah, the beginning parts of long novels or long films are always the hardest for me to get my, especially when it's something out of my element or something new where you have to establish the rules of the universe and all these characters. That's always the hardest part to get through. And with this being a 2.5 hour film out of what's, I assume, going to be 5 to 6 total hours of content, the first out 90 minutes of this, or 75 maybe, is that setup portion. And then the second half of this is very strong. And I'm hoping it'll continue that momentum into the second part.
Well, and I've seen the second part, so again, I won't give you spoilers, but I do think it gets better and better as far as how the story is told and getting into the material a little bit deeper.
Does anybody else have creative ways of walking across the desert, or do they all just cha-cha slide? Because that's what it looked like to me.
It's a pretty solid cha-cha slide approach. Yeah, okay. It's that or some other things. That have nothing to do with walking. I'll just tell you that.
Okay.
But yeah, it gets good. So question for you, are we going to do Dune 2? Not this month.
We can do Dune 2 at some point down the line. It doesn't have to be this month. But yeah, I'd be down to watch the second part because I think it will make my viewpoint on this a little stronger of the setup for it once I understand the entirety of the story.
Yeah. And honestly, I did the rewatch of the first one and then I went and saw the second one. And so it was hard for me to remember them as separate stories, actually. Mm. And I think as a single story, it's very compelling. So yeah, I'd be super interested.
What I really dig about it is, and I guess you could say the same thing about Star Wars too, but again, it just feels more sci-fi to me, but I like that this doesn't feel like a story about spaceships and intergalactic war and blah, blah, blah. It's more about politics and religion. I think those are the themes that sort of run through this more strongly, and also caste systems and just society. I think those are interesting themes to build a plot like this around.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting story about, like I said, those two kind of parallel motivations and understandings of the world and how they either clash or collaborate or don't. And it's interesting to see them continue to come together over the course of this story. So, but all that to say, I think it's, like I said, my rating is like a 7.5-ish, 7.5, something like that. And I would,
without any spoilers, can you say what you rated the second part and then maybe give us as a whole what you would do their combined score as?
I think the second part is a solid like 8.5. Okay. Yeah, I think they land at the 8. But I agree with you on both that like the visuals are a 10 out of 10 in both. So it's more story, acting, other stuff. But I think I would definitely rate the second one even higher, which doesn't always happen, as we know, in quote unquote sequels. Yes, it's two parts to one story, but it ultimately turns out to be a sequel. And yeah, I was very pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. I had a couple notes that I couldn't fit in organically, so I'm just going to blurt them out in no particular order. I thought it was cool that we mentioned Game of Thrones earlier, and the guy who designed the languages for this film is the same linguistic expert that designed Dothraki and Valyrian for the Game of Thrones series. So I guess he had worked with Jason Momoa before, so good for him. His name's David J. Peterson. And then,
man, he's really good at that. Let's just sidebar really quick, because like all of those just end up truly feeling like
they feel natural,
like natural languages. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Doesn't feel like nonsense.
What language. An interesting skill to have. That's amazing.
Yeah. And then I wanted to point out, this was actually, we talk about Hans Zimmer a lot the last few weeks because he scores everything, but this was actually his first Oscar since The Lion King. So even though he's done all the Nolans and all that, this was his first Oscar in 30 years. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And then the last thing I have is just that the little mouse in the desert is very cute.
Oh my God. So last fucking note. Cute. So fucking cute. I love the giant ears.
Yeah.
Ugh, adorable.
Is it a real animal? I feel
there
like
there is a real desert mouse. And it looks very similar. Yes. But they made it even cuter. Yeah, for sure.
See, George Lucas, not everything has to have six fucking eyes. Because it's
okay, but have you seen a porg? It's fucking adorable. So I don't want to talk about it. Stop picking on Star Wars, okay? We're going to fight. Anyway, just to keep Lamar from losing more fans for us, we're going to wrap it up.
Well, next week you'll get to piss off zombie movie fans.
Yes, so. I will. I was just about to say, come back next week to hear me rage against Dawn of the Dead for our 2004, for our next week of Inaugurate April. I was very intrigued, but yeah, no spoilers. Don't love zombie movies. So I'm going to be Lamar next week in this situation. But for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.